organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today, why, and what's next? Live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
Eight minutes after the hour of 5, as I continue to take you home on the Drive Home at 5, yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, from high atop Madison Square Garden and the great facilities provided to us by NJDiet.com. And right below us, yes, it was where the former aide-de-camp, the wartime consigliere, the leg breaker of Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, had his number one ally end up working. In fact, was working for Dolan, James Dolan of Madison Square Garden, who housed him down there as a vice president of community relations. I would see the guy who was on trial today, Joe Pococo, in the U.S. Southern District Court in downtown Manhattan on charges of shakedown and corruption. In fact, Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News, will give us the breakdown momentarily. But just to let you know a little bit of who this guy is and how important he has been to the political career of Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, Joe Pococo. Listen to how Andrew eulogized the passing of his father Mario recently at a church in the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
And my father's third son, who sometimes I think he loved the most, Joe Prococo, really did an extraordinary job, and they did an extraordinary job with his funeral, and we want to thank them.
Yeah, extraordinary job. As a young little whippersnapper out on Staten Island, the Forgotten Island, or what some call Satan Island, he went to Wagner College up on the hill. You would actually look out over the bay as you could peer out and see the Empire State Building in Manhattan. Could also look down and see Park Hill and Stapleton, the public housing complexes that produce Wu-Tang Clan and a bunch of other Uzi-toting, dope-sucking, psychopathic killing machines. So he knew how to straddle both arenas, unlike Andrew, who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth in Holliswood, Queens, right next to Donald Trump in the Jamaica Estates. No. Joe Pococo was chosen because he was Mario Cuomo's aspiring hitman and became Andrew Cuomo's political hitman, who would always go in and do the dirty work. Sort of like Tom Hagen, right? In The Godfather, he would meet with you and say, I don't want to go back and offend the governor. This is the offer. Either do it Andrew's way or there's going to be a price to pay. But now he's up on a series of serious charges. And even though I would see him every day go in and out of Madison Square Garden because he'd be working for Jimmy Dolan, you know, no-show job, it's showtime. So let's go to Ken Lovett once again, Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. Thanks for jumping on board again, Ken.
Good to be back.
Okay, so can you explain to us the charges that Joe Pococo is facing and what they involve?
Yeah, it's basically bribery charges, corruption charges, twofold. One, he's said to have gotten bribes from a company, Competitive Power Ventures, that wants to open up a power plant in Orange County, upstate Orange County, in the Hudson Valley. They not only gave him money, but they supposedly, allegedly, according to the complaint, gave his wife a no-show job. Then there's another charge that he accepted bribes that were basically funneled through another former Cuomo associate, a guy named Todd Howe, from a Syracuse development company. And the feds are basically saying he sold, you know, the Cuomo administration for bribes. Now, he would say that a lot of this went down when he wasn't with the administration. There was a time when he left to run Andrew Cuomo's reelection campaign in 2014, and that's when a lot of this money went. So he'll argue, how could I affect anything with an administration I'm not working for?
Ah, but he was running his reelection campaign at the time.
Yes, he was running his reelection campaign, and supposedly he told the governor that he wasn't coming back to the administration, which he ultimately did, and supposedly he told the governor that while I'm working on the campaign, I'm going to take on some private clients, and the governor has insisted that despite having a reputation as a micromanager, the governor has said that he never asked who those clients were.
Now, I know there are a number of other individuals who have worked for Andrew Cuomo or assisted him as governor in Albany, who themselves will be going on trial at a later date for somewhat similar corruption charges, all traced to the Buffalo Billions. But none of them are as close to the Cuomo family as Joe Percoco has been over the years, correct?
Absolutely. You cannot get closer to the governor than Joe Percoco. He dates back to his father's administration. He's someone who Cuomo trusted, the Cuomos, not just this Cuomo, trusted implicitly. He was a right-hand man. He was, you know, he wasn't a policy guy, so to speak. He was an aide who got things done. And he's one of the few people that Cuomo let into his orbit. You know, he's known for keeping people at arm's length. Percoco was not at arm's length.
Wouldn't it be safe to say, without being physical, that he was really the governor's personal political enforcer? That meant when there was dirty work to do, Joe would be more than happy to do it for the governor.
Absolutely. He was as loyal as could be, and still is, apparently, because he certainly, there's no talk that he tried to top a plea and try to throw the governor under the bus, but he was as loyal as can be, and yes, that was his reputation. He was Andrew Cuomo's chief political enforcer.
Now, if we look at the case of the Nassau County executive who was indicted.
Ed Mangano.
Right, Ed Mangano. His wife was given a no-show job by this restaurateur, Singh, who then became a cooperating witness, and Mangano, no doubt, will be going to jail for a long, long time as he has left office. So this would be somewhat similar if, in fact, Percoco's wife took a no-show job from that power company upstate, and Percoco actually took money from them. Couldn't the feds conceivably at some point in this process say to Joe, you know, we could easily indict your wife, obviously on a lesser charge, no-show job. But if you don't play ball with us, if you don't accede to our wishes, yeah, she's going to be right there with you, if not now, at a future trial date.
That was certainly one of the things that was speculated a lot about after, you know, look, this indictment goes back to 2016. So there was a lot of speculation about that. Would they try to squeeze him with the threats to his wife, which is, you know, which the feds do. They bring the family in. They did that against Shelley Silver, and they did it against other people. It is a tactic they try to use. Now, Percoco and his defense have argued, through his defense lawyer, have argued that it was not a no-show job, that she came up with some kind of development plan, you know, for schools, and that she actually did work for the company. You know, that's what's going to come out during the trial.
Now, how long do they anticipate this one trial, this Joe Percoco trial, going on at the U.S. District Court in the Southern District, downtown Manhattan?
It can go anywhere 4 to 6 weeks. And what's going to be interesting, Curtis, is not just what comes up, but who testifies. Is there anyone, you know, within the Cuomo orbit that is going to be a government witness that we don't know about yet? And also, what comes out, even if it's not illegal, what do we learn about how the Cuomo administration operates, especially when it comes to doling out billions of dollars of economic development funding? That is going to be really interesting. When Joe Bruno, the former majority leader of the state Senate, was on trial, one of the most interesting things that came out of it was when they said that the lawyer for the Senate Republicans always told them, when you're filing your financial disclosure forms, always hand-deliver it to the Legislative Ethics Commission, otherwise you could be hit with mail fraud if it's false. So rather than tell them, make sure that it's accurate, he tells them how to avoid mail fraud. And it's that kind of stuff that really we're going to see a shroud of secrecy really ripped off, and we're going to see inside the Cuomo administration. And that could be embarrassing both politically for the governor who's seeking re-election this year.
Do appreciate that, Ken Lovett. We'll be tapping into him as his court trial proceeds against the Michael Corleone of New York State politics. That's right. Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Perotta Cordo, King Cuomo I, runs his governorship and his stable of loyal sycophants, toadies, and lackeys as if it's an Italian organized crime family. But the reason that at the time Preet Bharara decided to go so strongly after Andrew Cuomo after he folded the Moreland Commission, which was investigating corruption of Sheldon Silver, a.k.a. Hyman Roth, a.k.a. Meyer Lansky, the Assembly Speaker, and Dean the Greek Skelos and his deadbeat son Adam and other corruptive measures on both sides of the aisle. The other reason is it's personal, and this story's never been told. Preet Bharara was a Harvard student and was totally mesmerized by Mario Cuomo. Came to work for him in his third attempt to get elected governor, which he did. In fact, I think against Peter Vallone Sr. Anyway, he was all wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and ideologically married to Mario Cuomo. And he was assigned to Andrew Cuomo, who was the campaign manager, Joe Pococco, and the other Italian stallions. And you know what they used to refer to Preet Bharara as? Gunga Din. Go tell Gunga Din to make a coffee run. Now, as a proud Indian American from the Indian subcontinent, I don't believe that Preet Bharara ever forgot that diss and dismiss, which made this indictment more than just professional, but made it personal.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel founder Curtis Sliwa.
Really try to help our cause.
WABCRadio.com.
We can't start a fire. We can't start a fire without a spark. This guns for hire. Even if we're just dancing.
26. Wow. It was a miserable week for Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, last week, as he had to clean out his office, leave Trenton. And then it was Wednesday night when he walked into the Walter Kerr Theater. If you've ever seen it in Times Square, it's a small theater compared to the other major theaters. And it's where Bruce Springsteen is on Broadway, where he's fetching many hundreds of dollars per seat. And he's obviously raking in the dough. Well, Chris Christie had said after he cleaned out his office, once Murphy was sworn in as the governor of New Jersey, that the very first thing he would do is to see the man that he idolizes, that he is a sycophant, toady, and lackey to. He might as well be a roadie of his in a relationship which is really almost S&M. I mean, Springsteen is like a sadist in this relationship. And Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, is the masochist, because how many times has Chris Christie praised the boss, former Bruce Springsteen, who writes off his massive property taxes by claiming his land is farmland? And naturally, Chris Christie, who might normally been all over his jockstrap on that, just let it pass under the radar screen. So here it is. He shows up. He gets a drink. He's in the second row. He can almost reach out and touch his hero, who won't even acknowledge him, won't even look at him. Even after he finished his performance and walked down the center aisle towards the side exit and his dressing room, wouldn't even high-five him, acknowledge him from the stage. Nothing. And there was Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, like a little girl, giggling and telling the crowd, "Oh, it's Bruce. It's Bruce." And he remembered the glory days. You remember that song, Glory Days? The glory day for Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, was, remember, after wearing that fleece sweater in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, and running around at the beck and call of then-President Barack Obama and squeezing him and hugging him so much that the president at the time almost lost his breath. Remember how all of a sudden Bruce Springsteen embraced him for the only time when they did that hurricane relief telethon in 2013 to get the only time he acknowledged him. And then as Barack Obama was running for re-election against Mitt Romney, and it was close at that time, Bruce had appeared in Columbus, Ohio at a major event, outdoor event, right off of Main Street, Ohio State University. It was like 100,000 people. He was performing. He introduced President Barack Obama. And then on Air Force One, flying back to D.C., Bruce teased Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie. Barack Obama called him up and said, "You want to talk to the boss?"
Yeah. "Can I talk to the boss?"
And all of a sudden, Springsteen said, "Oh, you did a good job. You did a good job in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, and you did a good job in embracing President Barack Obama."
Yeah. I do a good job.
Well, this past Wednesday night, at the end of the show, Christie stood, applauded, told anyone who would listen to him, "Oh, another great show." I think this is what? Show like 173 that he's seen. He's like the number one roadie and toady for Springsteen. Again, Springsteen would give him no recognition. And then all of a sudden, Chris Christie rode out into the dark. And the very next day, remember, tried to sneak in through the TSA line as if he were still governor, getting special privilege. And we need to find out. Justin B. Love, can you make yourself somewhat useful to us as our producer here for the Drive Home at 5? Can you find out who that brave TSA guy was at Newark International Airport? Because we're always making fun of them, not doing their job, falling asleep, being deadbeat slackers. I mean, here's a guy who tells Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, "No, you're no longer governor. You got to get on the line with everyone else. You got to take your shoes off. You got to take your belt off. Hey, look. You're going to have to hold up your trousers because we don't want your trousers dropping. You're going to have to go through the metal detector like everyone else." And Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, had to suck it up. It was a really rough, rough week. And then yesterday, which team? Hey, Brian Magalucci, you know who Chris Christie, when he had his, his tryout to replace Francesa at the Fan. Remember when he just tore into the Philadelphia Eagle fans as being uncouth knuckle draggers, jadrules, of which they are? We saw that yesterday. They're punching out horses. They're attacking their own police. They had to grease up, the telephone poles to make sure they didn't shimmy up the poles and start a riot after they unmercifully beat the Minnesota Vikings and sent them all back to Norway. Now the president's really going to be upset. There's no Norwegians in the United States at all after that. And he viciously attacked the Philadelphia Eagles fans. And boy, you should have seen the social network boards light up and say, "Hey, Jerry Jones' best friend, how your Dallas Cowboys doing now?" But there was Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, sailing off into the Atlantic Ocean. And he is now auditioning to become the den father for the Jersey Shore crew that's getting back together at Seaside Heights. In fact, he is willing, as part of this reality show, to be the consigliere to the situation who owes, what, $9 million to the IRS and is copping a plea. I don't know if many of you know, the situation man actually came from Staten Island. I believe he was a political science major and had intent in running for political office. So he had a little bit more going for him than Jay Wow, Snooki, and the rest of those degenerates. But can you imagine Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, in the new reality show, The Return of the Jersey Shore Crew, as their den father in that house in Seaside Heights?
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
There's nobody that knows this scene better than Curtis Sliwa.
WABCRadio.com.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed
540. Great Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song. And so applicable to our next guest here in the Drive Home at 5. We've talked to him a few months ago. He got all jammed up. This is in the midst, Kaepernick. He's taking a knee, followed by some other Gavones who decided to do it for a variety of reasons. Well, Steve Solomon decided to post on his Facebook as a Uniondale teacher how he had faced that same situation years prior in a classroom. And now he's really jammed up. I can't believe this. They're saying he's got all the furniture upstairs and rearranged in the wrong rooms, the shrink does, and they don't want him back at his job. Steve, tell us it ain't so. Tell us it ain't so, Steve.
Good evening, Curtis. First, glad your surgery went well and you're back on the air.
Well, thank you very much. But Steve, sort of recount for us what got you jammed up in your school district there in Uniondale.
Well, a friend of mine wrote on his post that teachers don't have kids stand for the pledge anymore or teach respect. So I answered him and told him a story that happened 10 years ago, and I said that two students refused to stand for the pledge. I requested that they did. I told them it was standing was respect for the country, for the flag, and the military people who fight for their freedom. They didn't care. They said it was their problem. They went to the principal, told him they didn't have to stand, and I made a comment, well, when they said they refused to stand, I said, what makes this country great is you don't have to stand and I don't have to pass you. I said it kind of mockingly with a smile on my face, and I said that God must have a sense of humor because both kids failed on their own. You know, and because they failed, because they show lack of respect for this country, by not standing, because they didn't show respect for their friends, for the classroom, because there were numerous classroom disturbances, I chose not to reward that behavior, and they failed. And then they came back to my class the next year, both of them. And when I said stand for the pledge, I looked over to them, and I made a comment, those two suckers were the first up. And because I made that joke, it was a true story, the district chose to suspend me because they got a lot of outrage from the community, and went to the board, PTA, and the district decided to suspend me because of that.
All right, now, how did it get to the point where they assigned you to a shrink? This almost reminds me of what the president recently had to go through when he got his health test, you know, at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
Right.
And the head doctor said, hey, you know, we have this cognitive test. No other president has taken it. And the president said, yeah, give me the cognitive test. And he aced 30 out of 30 questions. Did they give you a cognitive test or a Rorschach test?
No, first, they filed a 913 charge against me, claiming after 35 years of education and teaching I was not mentally competent. They sent me to a psychiatrist, ironically, his same last name as me, Dr. Solomon. But he acted like a DA. He was grilling me. He wasn't evaluating me. They were just talking about the negative. He was obviously hired by the district. And, you know, my question for you, Curtis, and for your listeners is, before that, I was teaching, had a very popular boxing club, trying to keep kids out of gangs.
Mm.
I was teaching kids to avoid using drugs. I was working with special needs kids. And because I requested two kids to stand for the pledge and learn to be patriotic for this country, they took me away from my job. So I say to you and your listeners, who needs the psychiatrist, me or the district?
Yeah, not only that, the implication is that you're insane in the brain, when in fact we need to be encouraging more teachers out there to get more personally involved and more concerned about the cases involving their students, as you've done. Particularly, we read story after story in Long Island Newsway. There are Bloods, there are Crips, there's 18th Street, there's MS-13, there's kids getting into trouble with Oxy and fentanyl and all kinds of drugs. You would think that they would be giving you an award instead of trying to run you out of your teaching career and claiming that, you know, you're a danger to your teaching profession.
Well, you know, thank you for saying that, Curtis. I appreciate that. God bless you. A lot of the kids in my boxing club say if it wasn't for me, they would be in gangs in the school.
Mm.
What worries me now is a lot of liberals out there, they want to take God out of the pledge completely, and they want to take God out of the currency. You know, this is the world we live in. We need to embrace God, not push God away, especially today in the world that we have. We need to be encouraging the kids to embrace God, to embrace this country, to be patriotic, love of country, civics. And it seems that people like myself who are doing that, they're coming against us.
Now,
you know,
Steve,
there's a law in New York State, Curtis, that
yes.
Teachers are required by law to stand for the pledge and recite the pledge with the students.
Hmm.
And I can tell you there's many teachers in my school that refuse to do that.
All right, but Steve Solomon, normally, your shop steward, whoever's in charge of the union there at your particular school, would have your back, whether it was in the New York City, the UFT, out in Jersey, it's the NJEA. I'm not sure what union represents you out there. Did the shop steward have your back? Did he cover your back in this?
You know, I feel that they're in the middle, they're uncomfortable, they don't know what to do because teachers are involved, teachers complained about me requesting the students to stand, so that the unions really doesn't have my back as much as I would hope they would. They're kind of playing neutral, and I'm a union rep. That's the ironic part about
wow.
it.
Wow.
But you know what, Curtis? I took a stand for my wonderful mother, Phyllis Boucher, who taught me right from wrong. Mm. I stand for my wife, Jacqueline Dominguez Salomon, who is my hero, for giving up her career for the most important, difficult job in America, being a housewife and raising my two wonderful boys, Zach and Jake, my pride and joy, and my stepfather, Paul, who was a World War II Marine hero. Okay, and he taught me to be a man. And any class I have for my mother, my wife, my stepfather.
Now, in drumming you out of teaching after 35 years, are they trying to deprive you or cut back on your pension?
I'm not sure. It's something I have to deal with the union. I mean, usually 913 is a precursor to what's called a 3020A, where they try to fire you, which I think is the next step. Mm. They could probably go off my pension, whatever I have to do. But they told me I needed to apologize to them for asking kids to stand for the pledge. And I told them I could never apologize for that.
Apologize.
I stand for the military. I stand for this country. And I refuse to back down and not do what I think about.
You're absolutely doing the right thing, Steve.
Thank you.
And you will have a bully pulpit right here on WABC on the drive home at 5. If you can keep our producer, Justin B. Love, in the loop in terms of, because I know what they're going to try to do to you. They're going to try to encroach upon your pension and just make your life even more miserable than they've already done.
Hey, could I just say one thing? There's another hero out there, Patrick Sullivan, a teacher who at 40 years old decided after 9/11 he was going to go back and join the Navy and the Navy Reserves when many people are retiring. And just to show you how educators feel about that, and another educator who was patriotic, because his principal, Mr. Letty, felt that it was inconveniencing him when he was being called on to do his job in the military, he asked Pat not to go, to change the dates. He said he had no control over that. He even called his commander and asked him to change Pat's days when he's supposed to fight in this world because it inconvenienced him. When Pat went and the Navy guy refused to do it, he demoted Pat from a dean to a teacher. And now him and the dean and the AP, Miss Balfour, are harassing this guy because he's trying to protect his country because he wants to make a change and do something right.
Well, I tell you what, Steve, please keep us in the loop because, you know, with the passing of Tom Petty over the weekend, the announcement of his death, he OD'd too many fentanyl patches. Hey, Tom, I use fentanyl patches. I could have told you. You put four on, one below, one to the left, one above the right breast, one the left breast, and that's it. But apparently because he was touring, he had chronic pain in his hips, and he's abused drugs before. He passed away because he OD'd on fentanyl patches. But this classic song applies to the teacher you just heard us speak to, Steve Solomon, the Uniondale teacher who's been kicked out of his classroom because he said, hey, kids, stand up and show respect for the national anthem. Well, if you missed it this morning on Imus and the Warning, Don Imus announced that he would be leaving radio as of March 29th and riding off into the sunset. Wow, that's major. Guy's been in radio for 50 years. He's iconic. And obviously, it's the changing of the guard. Many of you may not have listened. So, appointment radio tomorrow, 6 to 9. You're going to want to be listening as Imus explains further as to why he's riding off into the sunset on March 29th and who it might be that replaces him in that morning drive time here at WABC. Listen tomorrow.